Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
As 2014 draws to a close, we're taking a look at two novels that will have a life both in the old year and in the new. Both centre on families, though not without some ambivalence on the part of the Bengali-born writer Neil Mukherjee, whose The Lives of Others narrowly missed this year's Booker Prize and is now one of four novels in contention for the Costa Novel of the Year, which will be announced in January 2015. We'll find out later why he decided to write a variation of that cliché of modern literature, the Indian family saga. But first, we head squarely into the American heartlands with the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley, whose new novel, Some Luck, is the first in a trilogy which will take an Iowan farming family through nearly a century of ups and downs.
After harvest, Walter and Ragnar, with help from Ralph, Kurt, and John, put an addition on the west side of the house, a room for Frankie and Joey, so that Lillian could have their room. Walter couldn't afford a two-story addition. If the boys wanted Rosanna or Walter, they had to go through the front room and call up the stairs. But Frank was 8 by the time it was finished, and they moved in. And hadn't John and Gus been sleeping downstairs on the back sleeping porch off the kitchen of Rosanna's parents' house since Gus was 5 and John was 7? Walter put 2 windows in the south side of the addition and a window on the west side, but no window into the north side. He also studded out a future opening so that one day he could install a door. But just the thought of Frankie with a door to call his own made him nervous. He had not spared the ride, and he had not, therefore, spoiled the child. But Frankie was the most determined child he had ever seen, far surpassing himself, Howard, Rolf, and everyone else on Rosanna's side of the family. It was as if, when he saw certain things, his brain simply latched onto them and would not let them go. It wasn't even contrariness. Half the time, Walter could say, "Frankie, don't do that." And Frankie wouldn't do whatever it was because he didn't care about it. The other half of the time, it didn't matter what Walter said or even what Frankie said. There was a bucket of 3.5-inch nails. Walter said, "Frankie, leave the nails alone." "Okay, Papa." "I mean it." "Yes, Papa." An hour later, the bucket of nails was turned over and Frankie was sifting through them. "Frankie, I told you not to touch the nails." "I wanted to find something." "What?" "A longer nail." "I told you not to touch the nails." "But I wanted to find it." "I forbade you." "But I wanted to find it." "Did you find it?"
"No."
"Now I have to give you a whipping." And then he took off his belt and grasped the buckle, and holding Frankie by the upper arm, had him take down his pants. "What did I tell you?" Whack.
"Not to touch the nails."
Whack. "If I tell you not to touch the nails, you are not to touch the nails." Whack.
"I wanted to find it."
Whack. "What do I do if I tell you not to touch the nails and you touch the nails?" Whack.
"Whip me."
Whack. "Why did you touch the nails?"
Whack.
"I wanted to find it."
Whack.
"Are you going to do that again if I tell you not to?"
Whack.
"No, Papa."
Whack.
But of course he did. Nails, after all, were not the same as crawling under the front porch or climbing to the very top of the tree or standing on the roof of the house or dropping from the hay loft, where he was not supposed to be in the first place, onto Jake's back. What would happen if they got electricity? That was the rumor lately, especially since they were so close to town. It was expensive, but worth it, everyone said. Walter could only imagine. For Frankie, the wires would be a constant temptation just to try this with a screwdriver or that with a fork. It seemed as though Frankie had to be taught every single lesson in every variation, and yes, Miss Jenkins over at the school said that Frankie was the smartest child she had ever seen in her life and was on to division, not to mention training for the spelling bee at the end of the school year. And I do not know who is going to give him any competition. Certainly, he went to school willingly and even enthusiastically every morning, so that was something to be thankful for. Walter didn't know what to make of his two boys. If you looked at it a certain way, then the one who needed the beatings to toughen him up, namely Joey, never did a thing to earn a beating because he hadn't the gumption, and the one who got the beatings learned nothing from them. Looking back on his own child, Walter saw a much more orderly system. His father and mother told them the rules if they got out of line, not even intending to. They got a whipping to help them remember the next time, and they did remember the next time, and so they got fewer beatings, and so they became boys who could get the work done. Since there was plenty of it, it had to get done. That was life, as far as Walter was concerned. You surveyed the landscape and took note of what was needed, and then you did it. And the completed tasks piled up behind you like a kind of treasure, or at least evidence of virtue. What life was for Frankie, he could not imagine.
Jane, this is your 14th novel, I think, for adults, something like that. And it's the start of a trilogy, which is going to tell the story of America, or a story of America, through this family. So it's not just about Frankie, although Frankie is in some ways its most colourful character.
Well, he's the trunk of the tree, sort of.
Tell us about the project.
Well, the entire trilogy is called The Last 100 Years, and the name, the title of the trilogy was the first thing I came up with. Once I came up with that title, I told it to a friend, and he said, oh, don't tell anybody that title. They'll want to steal it. And I thought, oh, that's good. As I thought of the title, I realized that I wanted the books to progress 1 year at a time from 1920 to 2019. And that therefore each year had to be long enough so that something, several things, maybe many things went on in that year. So I knew it was going to have to be a trilogy because it'd be too much for one volume. It follows this family, Walter and Rosanna. They have a farm in Iowa. It's a very deeply indebted farm. And Frank is the first child. He's born in 1920 on January 1st, 1920. And successive children are born. All the children are quite different from one another, and they go out into the world in very different ways.
The fact that they live in the middle of nowhere, sort of, on this little failing,
well, they wouldn't
struggling
say that.
Farm, they certainly wouldn't say that. But it does mean that you lose a lot of the sort of reference that one would expect from a great historical novel. You don't have the Jazz Age. You don't have gangsters in Chicago, all those sort of things. Here they are plodding away, trying to survive.
Well, the reason I started on the farm is because how you raise the food that you eat as a culture really says a lot about you as a culture. And one of the greatest changes in American life over the last 100 years has been in the way we raise food. So I wanted to get that. That's the root. But also, I wanted them to move away. I wanted, you know, there's 5 kids. And they move to lots of different places, and they see lots of different things. So they have that experience that a lot of Americans and other people have had, too, of moving from the periphery to the center. And what does that look like, and what does that feel like? So I think I got a lot from setting it in Iowa, not middle of nowhere, but at the center.
A critic has described this as a Steinbeckian Little House on the Prairie, which I really love, because I was a huge fan of Little House on the Prairie. And I have to say, it does have that sort of, it's more a pacing in a way, and a temperament, isn't it, than a story.
I don't know how to answer this. You know, I don't think of it in terms of what it's like. I think of it in terms of what it is to me. And it is my exploration of this period. And because it's first set in the Midwest, it seems to people who are not from the Midwest to be, you know, slow and easygoing. But people who live on a farm find, you know, the ups and downs of day-to-day life pretty terrifying. And so I wanted to get that in, especially a farm life during the Depression. I would not say that Walter and Rosanna adhere to any kind of particular independent, you know, I'm on my own and I'm free. You know, they're just hoping to get through the day.
We're used to big American novels that cover big swathes of history. They're usually written by men, and they're sort of ballsy. And this, I wondered to what extent this is the woman's answer to big history. It's domestic. It's very detailed. It studies each individual person.
Well, I try to get it all in. I mean, there's war, and there's babies, and there's food, and there's money, and there's landscape, and there's small things too. So I didn't want to necessarily do a female version, but I wanted to do a very expansive version that basically says, okay, we're not paying any attention to what particular genders think is important. We're trying to look at everything as best we can.
In terms of the actual farming story, which a lot of this story does involve, it's in a way, it's a reverse of the American dream, isn't it? Because they go through the Depression, they go through terrible drought. The farm is diminishing animal by animal, acre by acre during the century.
Well, not during the century, but during this first 30 years. The first volume covers 33 years. And the farm is in okay shape in the 20s. It's a diverse farm, and it does what it's supposed to do. They manage to pay their bills and live pretty well. And Walter's father actually, his farm is larger and is all paid off. And the next door neighbor's farm is pretty luxurious. And then the 1940s come and the war comes, and they're quite prosperous for, 10 or 12 years, maybe through the 50s. So, you know, farming in America has always had its ups and downs, and the boom periods don't last very long.
Let's talk a bit more about Frank.
Okay.
Frank, who is the sort of star of the family. But Frank, effectively, he's too good at listening, isn't he? Too good at eavesdropping.
Frank is very observant. And, you know, maybe he's farsighted, I don't know. But he loves to pay attention and to watch. And he also loves to get in trouble. He's quite adventurous. And he is just one of those children, many of them boys, who's, it's not like he's out of control. He's not, I wouldn't say he's resistant. It's more like his attention is elsewhere. He loves going to school. He loves learning things. But he also, as far as his mother is concerned, doesn't seem to reciprocate her affections very well. And we've seen those kids, you know, the ones who just have their eyes on the horizon and have the wherewithal to do whatever they want.
But his eavesdropping is used. I mean, later on.
Yes.
He becomes involved in industrial espionage, doesn't he, effectively?
Well, let's talk about what he does in the war first. I mean, he goes to boot camp in Missouri, Fort Leonard Wood, and one of the commanders in the boot camp decides that some of his soldiers should be snipers, and Frank is one of them. So they give him a little test, and it's an observation test where he has to name everything on somebody's desk. He has to look at the desk and turn around and then name everything on the desk. And he names everything on the desk, and then he says, and I forgot to mention the fly that was crawling around. You know, so they do send him to the war as a sniper, and he starts in the African campaign, and then he goes on through the Italian campaign. And he has an interesting, I wouldn't say he has a lovely war, but he has an interesting war as far as he's concerned. He's very convinced that the generals do not know what they're doing, that if they asked him, he could give them some good advice. And then after the war, he gets involved with Lillian is his sister, who was born in 1926. And she is spirited away from the drugstore where she works by a mysterious traveler who's heading for Maryland. And his name is Arthur. He's one of my favorite characters. I truly love Arthur. He talks Frank into doing a few things for him. And they aren't industrial espionage. They're real espionage.
Real espionage.
But they're side. He's helping Arthur do his job, I think.
I wanted to ask you about the way in which you tell this story. You're constantly changing points of view. Each character has little sections. So chapters are divided up into different sort of kaleidoscopic sections.
Yes, I wanted to enter all the characters' minds and have them perceive the world around them and have some of their thoughts be communicated to others, but not all of their thoughts. Because I wanted to see their world in different lights, you know. And so we start with the babies. Almost most of the first chapter is from Frank's point of view, and he's not even a year old yet. And that was a fun part.
Lovely when you see Frank sort of looking at the world, trying to get toddled to his feet and all that sort of thing.
That was really enjoyable for me to do. But that's because I wanted to follow these characters from birth till death. I wanted to explore what goes on in their minds as they pass through various stages of life. And not only Frank, but the other characters too. So all of the children, we see the world through their points of view sometime or other. I try not to lose track of anybody completely. And I think possibly I had to be, because I was switching points of view and because I was covering a lot of time, the prose has to be very straightforward so that the reader doesn't get confused.
And two of the high points, of wonderful low high points of just the parents, Walter and Rosanna, looking back and saying, yes, we've created all this. And there are two distinct moments which you could say are the high points of the novel.
Well, yes, and they're just, one of them is at a Thanksgiving dinner. And Rosanna suddenly looks around and looks at all their children and she thinks, wow, there's 23 different worlds here. And I remember looking at my children when they were first born and knowing that I had given birth to a world. So I put that in there.
The festive season is fast approaching. So this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
Jane Smiley. Some Luck is out now from Mantle, and the second volume, Early Warning, will be published in February. On now to a writer with an altogether more complicated attitude to the literature of the family, Neil Mukherjee. He opens The Lives of Others with a scene that has no place for Smiley-esque gentleness.
May 1966. A third of the way through the half-mile walk from the landlord's house to his hut, Nitai Das's feet begin to sway. Or maybe it is the head spin again. He sits down on the lifeless field he has to cross before he can reach his hut. There isn't a thread of shade anywhere. The May sun is an unforgiving fire. It burns his blood dry. It also burns away any lingering grain of hope that the monsoons will arrive in time to end this third year of drought. The earth around him is beginning to fissure and crack. His eyelids are heavy. He closes them for a while, then, as sleep begins to take him, he pitches forward from his sitting position and jolts awake. Absently, he fingers his great enemy, the soil, not soil anymore, but compacted dust. Even its memory of water has been erased forever, as if it has never been. He has begged all morning outside the landlord's house for one cup of rice. His three children haven't eaten for 5 days. Their last meal had been a handful of hay stolen from the landlord's cowshed and boiled in the cloudy yellow water from the well. Even the well is running dry. For the past 3 years, they had been eating once every 5 or 6 or 7 days. The last few times he had gone to beg had yielded nothing except abuse and forcible ejection from the grounds of the landlord's house. In the beginning, when he had first started to beg for food, they shut and bolted all the doors and windows against him while he sat outside the house for hours and hours, day rolling into evening into night, until they discovered his resilience and changed that tactic. Today they had set their guards on him. One of them had brought a stick down on Nitai's back, his shoulders, his legs, while the other one had joked, "Where are you going to hit this dog? He's nothing but bones. We don't even have to hit him. Blow on him and he'll fall back." Oddly, Nitai doesn't feel any pain from this morning's beating. He knows what he has to do. A black billow makes his head spin again, and he shuts his eyes to the punishment of white light. All he needs to do is walk the remaining distance, about 2,000 hands. In a few moments, he is all right. Some kind of jittery energy makes a sudden appearance inside him, and he gets up and starts walking. Within seconds, the panting begins, but he carries on. A dry heave interrupts him for a bit. Then he continues. His wife is sitting outside their hut, waiting for him to return with something, anything, to eat. She can hardly hold her head up. Even before he starts taking shape from a dot on the horizon to the form of her husband, she knows he's returning empty-handed. The children have stopped looking up now when he comes back from the fields. They have stopped crying with hunger, too. The youngest, 3 years old, is a tiny, barely moving bundle, her eyes huge and slow. The middle one is a skeleton sheathed in loose, polished black skin. The eldest boy, with distended belly, has become so listless that even his shadow seems dwindled and slow. The bones have eaten up what little flesh they had on their thighs and buttocks. On the rare occasions when they cry, no tears emerge. Their bodies are reluctant to part with anything they can retain and consume. He can see nothing in their eyes. In the past, there was hunger in them. Hunger and hope, an end of hope and pain, and perhaps even a puzzled resentment. A kind of muted accusation, but now there is nothing, a slow beyond the end nothing. The landlord has explained to him what lies in store for his children if he does not pay off the interest on his first loan. Nitai has brought them into this world of misery, of endless, endless misery. Who can escape what's written on his forehead from birth? He knows what to do now. He picks up the short-handed sickle, takes his wife by her bony wrist, and brings her out in the open. With his practiced farmer's hand, he arcs the sickle and brings it down and across her neck. He notices the fleck of spit in the two corners of her mouth, her eyes huge with terror. The head isn't quite severed. Perhaps he didn't strike with enough force, so it hangs by the still uncut fibers of skin and muscle and arteries as she collapses with a thud. Some of the spurt of blood has hit his face and his ribcage, which is about to push out from its dark, sweaty cover. His right hand is sticky with blood. The boy comes out at the sound. Nitai is quick. He has the energy and focus of an animal filled with itself and itself only. Before the sight in front of the boy can tighten into meaning, his father pushes him against the mud wall and drives the curve of the blade with all the force in his combusting being across his neck, decapitating him in one blow. This time the blood, a thin lukewarm jet, hits him full on his face. His hand is so slippery with blood that he drops the sickle. Inside the tiny hut, his daughter is sitting on the floor, shaking, trying to drag herself into a corner where she can disappear. Perhaps she has smelled the metallic blood or taken fright at the animal moan issuing out of her father, a sound not possible of humans. Nitai instinctively rubs his right hand, his working hand, against his bunched-up lungi and grabs hold of his daughter's throat with both his hands and squeezes and squeezes and squeezes until her protruding eyes almost leave the stubborn ties of their sockets and her tongue lolls out and her thrashing legs still. He crawls on the floor to the corner where their last child is crying her weak, runty mewl and with trembling hands covers her mouth and nose, pushing his hands down, keeping them pressed until there is nothing. Nitai does know what to do. He lifts the jerrycan of Folidol left over from 3 seasons ago and drinks, his mouth to the lip of the plastic canister, until he can drink no more. His insides burn numb, and he thrashes and writhes like a speared earthworm, thrashes and writhes, a pink form emerging from his mouth, until he too is returned from the nothing in his life to nothing.
Neil, that is a very shocking, harrowing opening to this novel. And it's an interesting choice. It's the prologue. And it's an interesting choice because Nitai Das isn't part of the Ghosh family who are at the centre of the rest of the novel.
But he actually provides one of the central characters of the Ghosh family, Suprateek, who becomes a Maoist revolutionary or a Naxalite in the West Bengal countryside at the end of the 60s. He actually provides him and his movement with their reason for being, as it were. And you could argue that this prologue has nothing to do with the book, and you'd be right. But you could also equally correctly say that it has everything to do with the book. It casts its long shadow through the rest of the narrative, and the entire political, the obvious political motor of the book is you can take this event as sort of, you know, an ignition key for that motor, actually.
It's a very interesting book because in some ways it's set up like a typical saga of the like of which we often get out of the Indian subcontinent, particularly. And you've got maps in the front and a family tree and all those sort of things. And it's sort of very dynastically complicated. But it has two very distinct strands, and you're doing something different with the novel here, aren't you?
Yes, I was actually interested in deconstructing the notion of family and therefore a family saga. I was trying to look at the economic basis on which middle-class families rest and their foundations of work and the way things like labor and capital and income, they kind of interact with each other to create the foundations on which all kinds of social structures are based, such as, you know, the individual, the family, social institutions, classes. I was trying to look at the contradictions of each of these classes as well, and the sort of instability and the imbalances built into them. So yes, I kind of use the family saga as a stepping stone, you know, in order to attempt a kind of blowing apart of the family saga, if you will.
How specific is what happens in it to Calcutta in the 1960s? Obviously, Supratik, the particular political movement, he joins the Naxalites. Yeah. That's very particular to that time and that place.
Yes. Well, I tried to render this world in as much detail as I could. So it is very much a product of its time, its history and the place and the culture. So yes, it is very particular, and the prologue which you just heard is actually a news item from a Bengali newspaper of May 1966, and I sort of pulled out and imagined it in greater detail, what would happen. The final epilogue in the book, which is set in 2012, I found the story of the contemporary Maoist insurgent in a recent book about Maoist activism in India, and I pulled out her story as well and sort of imagined her life. So yes, these are all very anchored particulars.
One of the things that you explore is where empathy gets you. It can get you everywhere and nowhere.
Yes,
and there's a particular shocking scene between Supratik and the family servant.
Yes, the cook.
Supratik suddenly sort of reverts to the superiority of his ancestors, his caste.
Yes, I was trying to work out how, you know, George Eliot's big theme of how the novel can make us brings the trivial and the great all in sort of collision with each other and in a kind of bond of great empathy, and it allows us to imagine other people's lives. And, you know, the novel is the only thing we have which allows us the inside view. And so it is predicated on things like empathy and imagining other people's interiorities and imagining narratives for their lives. So it's a very moral form, I think. It's based on the whole notion of empathy. I was trying to look at what happens when different notions of empathies collide, or different classes and different sets of people. What are the limits to their imagining of other people's lives, and what would the bottom line be? Would they actually go the full distance and empathize in a way that would liberate them from their own class boundaries and make them someone else? Or whether they would still, ultimately, they would be locked within their own limitations and their class boundaries. I was trying to test the limits of empathy, yes, of course. Yeah.
To what extent is this your story? The story of your background, your culture, your cultural heritage?
I was born much after the Naxalite Revolution was over. But, you know, I was born in Calcutta and I was brought up there. I went to school there. I went to university there. I came to this country when I was 22 years old, and I grew up bilingual. It's not the class bracket I was born in, I must say. So I did not live in the kind of world that the Ghoshes live in this book. But I know this world very well, and culture changes very slowly, I feel. So in the 70s, when I was growing up in Calcutta, I kind of knew this world in the way one knows the place where one is born and one grows up in and one lives for many years. So the people in the Ghosh family were quite easy to do, actually. I feel so much of it had sort of percolated into me by a process of cultural osmosis. I mean, you know, through Bengali books and Bengali literature and friends and people around me, neighbours, chatter, gossip.
It's a novel of the land as well, isn't it? You've got some very, very intimate descriptions of what it is to live in rural Bengal at that time, or what it was.
Yes, you know, rural Bengal has changed like everything else. And I was trying to, when I was doing the research for the rural sections of the book, I had to go, I went to this particular district, Medinipur, which is in western West Bengal, and is on the border with Jharkhand now. It used to be Bihar then. I had to find people who used to do rice cultivation by hand because it's all mechanized now. And the countryside has changed too. While I was doing the research, I was thinking it's not possible to get into a time machine in order to go back to late 60s rural Bengal, which was more rural than it is now. And so I had to imagine lots of it as well.
Neil Mukherjee. The Lives of Others will be out in paperback on January the 8th. And that's all from us for this week. We'll be picking up the theme of families in our Christmas blog series on theguardian.com. Contributions will range all the way from Mary Norton's The Borrowers and Louisa May Alcott's Little Women to Dickens' litigious Jarndyce's In Bleak House. Cold comfort there. If you have a favourite fictional family you'd like to write about or see represented in the series, drop me an email on claire.armitstead@guardian.co.uk. Until next week, from me and my producer, Eva Krishak, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.